History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are always stories out there that should not go untold. Our mission is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we go down that road, we're always better off for it. We're educated, we're entertained, often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. I'll remember to share some exciting news on the education piece of that a little bit later, but today we have the chance to hear the kind of story that for decades we didn't think we'd ever hear. Another historic warship discovered at the bottom of the ocean nearly 77 years after it was sunk, but found now while a few survivors of its sinking still remain. The late Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen commissioned the research vessel Petrel to hunt for World War II ships lost at sea. The son of a World War II veteran, Allen was still alive when the Petrel discovered the USS Indianapolis, which had delivered the components of the atomic bomb before it was torpedoed by the Japanese, leading to the worst shark attack in recorded history. He also got to revel in the discovery of another cruiser, the USS Helena, in Iron Bottom Sound off of Guadalcanal, and the aircraft carrier USS Lexington, which had been lost in the Battle of the Coral Sea in 1942. Allen passed away in October after a courageous fight with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, but the crew of the Petrel has continued that quest to locate historic ships. And last month, the Petrel announced the discovery of the aircraft carrier USS Hornet, which had famously launched the Doolittle raid on Tokyo in April of 1942, but was sunk in the Battle of the Santa Cruz Islands 6 months later. CBS News had exclusive access aboard the Petrel during the quest to locate the Hornet, and you can watch some of that video at hometownheroesradio.com. It includes a survivor of the Hornet laying eyes on his ship for the first time in three quarters of a century. There are still a handful of Hornet survivors left, and we have the privilege of hearing from one today on Hometown Heroes. Iowa native Bob Cole is 96 now. He was just 19 when he was wounded during the attack on the Hornet. We had the privilege of showing Bob some of the images from the carrier's wreckage, including a 5-inch gun like the one he used to sit under. Now it's 3.5 miles deep on the ocean floor.
You know, 3.5 miles down? That's a long way down there. When I have my regular duties, I sit on the 5-inch gun, you know, the seat, and watch for, at night, watch to see if any lights are on or anything, to spot anything, that like sampans and all that. And all of that, at night, my Doolittle, the pilots and all the, they would come out to stretch. And they were told, you don't light up any cigarettes. Because they can see that light for miles. But I got a chance to meet them, you know, talk to them, see how, you know, what their family lives and all that.
And so when you would sit on one of those 5-inch guns, that's what you were looking for, was lights in the distance?
On my side, yeah.
What is it like to look at pictures of your ship right now, 77 years almost after it sunk?
77, yeah.
What does that feel like to see it?
Well, you know, it really makes me reminisce of what that many years that this happened.
Have you ever wondered over the years if they'd ever find it?
No. No, because I've talked to other people at the Veterans Hospital, and they're on different ships, not aircraft carriers, but like destroyers or something like that. And they always wondered if their ship would ever be found, and then they gave up on it.
So you had pretty much given up too then, probably,
I had,
huh?
Oh, yeah. When my daughter-in-law called me and said, hey, they found your ship. I said, what are you talking about? She said, no, they found your ship and it was 3.5 miles down.
Hard to believe. Incredible, but true. You can find a video of Bob looking at some of those scenes from 3.5 miles down at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. When the Petrel found those other ships, we heard from survivors of each one of them here on this program, and it was fun to go back and listen to our original interview with Bob from 2013. One of the things we talked about was what he would look for if he could hypothetically go back aboard his sunken ship. We'll get to that, but to get the full context of this remarkably resilient man's story, let's go back to his hometown of Odo, Iowa.
How big is Odo, Iowa?
300 people.
Wow, that's a big city.
Two stop signs.
What was life growing up for you in Odo, Iowa?
Well, it was pretty poor, and you had to play basketball and baseball, but no football because you didn't have enough people, didn't have enough boys. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to go to college, and I ended up joining the Navy because they said I get a year of college for every year I'm in the service. So I signed up for 4 years.
And this was before Pearl Harbor?
Before. This is in August of 41.
Why the Navy as opposed to another branch of the service? Was it because you didn't have much water around Odo, Iowa, or what?
Well, two reasons. One, because only the Navy recruiter came to our school, and I believed in, if I'm going to go to war, I want to ride, not walk.
And did you understand from the things that were going on in the world at that point, was it clear to you that maybe America would be at war sometime soon?
Didn't have any speculation at all that wars. All I was interested in is get my 4 years in and get go to college. But lo and behold, it happened.
Not exactly the way you planned it. And so you join in August of 41, and they take you from a city of 300 to Great Lakes Training Station, which is just outside one of the biggest cities in the world there.
I mean, I'm going to comment on that. The largest building we have in Odo was a grain elevator. We get Liberty out of Great Lakes, and I got in Chicago, and I was on Michigan Avenue, and all of a sudden a drawbridge goes up, and I'm standing there in awe, seeing the Tribune building, and horns are honking at me, get out of the street. I almost got run over because I couldn't believe this bridge going up and a boat going through.
A lot bigger than a grain elevator, huh?
Oh, man, I tell you.
So it was a real eye-opener for you.
Real eye-opener. And then when I graduated from the Great Lakes, they sent me to Norfolk, Virginia, on board an aircraft carrier Hornet, CV-8, by the way, because CV-12 was in a museum in Oakland now, you know.
What was your first impression of the CV-8, the Hornet? How big a ship was that? That's probably bigger than Odo.
Well, when I went aboard there, we had 3,000 people, 3,000 sailors. Mm-hmm. And that was a culture shock, coming from 300 people to 3,000 people. And seeing this great big ship, the only thing I've ever seen was a little boat going down a river. And so we didn't have any airplanes, you know, because all the airplanes were, when they did get on there, were propeller-driven and not jets. And we didn't have any guns when war broke out, and so we hadn't even been commissioned yet.
Well, that begs the question, what do you remember about when the war did break out? Where were you on December 7th, 1941, and how'd you hear about it?
I was in Norfolk, Virginia, on board the aircraft carrier, and we heard it from our captain over the loudspeaker. Then afterwards, you know, the news flashes all over, so we heard it from the radios also. From there, we went, got all our stuff in a hurry, and they shipped us to, went through the Panama Canal and went to the West Coast in Alameda, and that's where we picked up Doolittle and his airplanes.
Yeah, this is pretty historic stuff, but I'm curious what it felt like to you as a young man, because here you are, I guess you would have been 19 years old when Pearl Harbor happened. You're away from home. You're on this aircraft carrier, and all of a sudden now there's a war going on. What did that do to you emotionally, mentally? How did you process that?
First thing we did, we all gathered around and prayed in our own department and hoped for the best of us. And to me, I never experienced anything like this before. I never, you know, I read about World War One, but I never visualized we're going to be in a war. And I thought this is going to be 4 years of... like the Navy says, come and join the Navy and see the world. And I didn't get to see the world very much.
Not all the parts you wanted to see anyway. And give us a sense of what your duties on the ship were.
I was a storekeeper, and what we did was did the payroll for the sailors on board. We also operated the, what they call a concession stand, where the crew could come in and buy candy or ice cream. Cigarettes. By the way, cigarettes were 3 cents a pack. It was no taxes. And I didn't smoke, so that was my duties as payroll and helping run the concession stand for the crew.
It probably made you a pretty popular guy on that ship.
Oh yeah. Because we weren't open very often, you know, maybe 4 or 5 hours a day, and different people would run it. I enjoyed every bit of it.
So you mentioned going through the Panama Canal and then around to the West Coast, and you picked up Doolittle and his pilots. Now, this was just unheard of at the time. Everything they were doing was crazy. The deck was not designed to have B-25s fly off it. They had to modify the B-25s to get them to take off in such a short distance. But I'm curious what you guys, as a crew of that ship, knew about this whole thing. What did you see happening, and what were you starting to figure out?
Well, at first we didn't know we were going to go to Japan. We just knew that they told we have a mission. They're not going to say anything because they didn't want anybody to know what we're doing. And so all we knew is we were taking them to some place, and after we left the United States, we found out where we were going. We weren't too excited about that. You know, going to war, are we going to last my 4 years or what? What if I get sunk?
Those questions would be answered eventually. Was there a buzz on this ship about these 16 airplanes and these pilots and crews that were aboard?
Very much so, especially when we got to Alameda and they found out what we were going to do. Like you say, number one, how are they going to fly off this thing? Because there's no jets or anything like that. And so it was a buzz. I mean, it was really talked about, hoping that whatever mission we're on, that it'd be a good one.
And I think pretty much everyone in every theater of the war had their mail censored. But were you guys given specific instructions not to say anything about this development?
That's right. We told everything. Don't you write back home or anything like that. Don't mention anything about it. Just carry on a conversation, a normal one. We make sure we wrote home and told them that we're alive, but we couldn't tell them what our missions were, though.
There's a lot of material that's been written about the Doolittle Raid. There are movies that have been made. And one thing that I've always found interesting was the timing of the whole thing. And it's somewhat similar to D-Day, where the timing they planned wasn't the timing that happened. And they ended up leaving early because they thought the Japanese had spotted them. Did you experience any of what was going on there when they actually took off? Did people find out? Did you see them taking off?
One of my guard duties at night was to man the 5-inch cannon and also look out the night and see if he saw anything. And then the pilots would come out and visit us. They can't smoke because of a little teeny light would be seen. And also we were told that we were going to go within 600 miles of Japan, Tokyo. But at 800 miles, they spotted the sampans. And we knew the sampans had walkie-talkies or whatever you want to call it. So that's when they had to adjust their plan. So instead of taking off at 600 miles in Tokyo, they took off at around 800 miles of Tokyo. We're on what they call general quarters. And so in my case, I didn't get a chance to see him take off because my general quarters were different from my regular yard duty. So we didn't get to see him take off at all.
But I'm sure you heard about it.
Oh, yeah. We heard those big, I mean, they're a lot louder than a little F-16 or an SB bomber taking off by the...
You hear those two engines of the B-25 going, and you know something's happening. Do you remember, and maybe this wasn't the case, but were people speculating aboard ship on what might happen to these planes and whether they thought they'd make it where they were going? Did anyone have any idea what they were doing?
No one knew, and I don't think anybody expected them to be... anybody come back alive because, if you know, ground fire, did they have enough gas go all the way? We didn't know where their destination was as they did their bombing. So
they didn't really know either.
No, that's right. That's right.
That's what makes that story so incredible, that these pilots and these crew members really did sign up for a suicide mission, not knowing where they'd be able to land, if they'd be treated well. And it's amazing that that they did as well as they did. When you've heard that story over the years, what's been the most impressive or inspiring aspect to you about all those planes and what they were able to do and the fact that so many of them did make it?
Well, it really, when we learned about it, you know, because they told us, the captain came over with a loudspeaker and told us all these things that happened. They didn't know, you know, 100%, but they told them that so far it's 75% good so far. Uh-huh. Now it's 80% good so far. And then they told us about a couple of them didn't, you know, I don't know how many went down, didn't make it, but I read the story, so we were very elated on the outcome.
So I imagine somewhere in that announcement on the loudspeaker, he said, those B-25s bombed Tokyo.
Yeah, they bombed Tokyo, and most of them made it out of there all right, and they're on their own. There was a few casualties, and, you know, made us feel real good. We had a part of it.
And the way history remembers that raid is not so much that the actual physical damage was a huge blow, but that the emotional power of what happened there was significant, not just to the Japanese, who now suddenly felt vulnerable, but to America to say, you know what, you hit Hawaii, well, we hit Tokyo. What did that feel like for you guys on the ship after having experienced Pearl Harbor, knowing what happened there, to hear some of our planes just bomb Tokyo?
Well, we felt real good about it because not the eye for eye or tooth for tooth business, but the idea that if you attacked us, you're going to pay for it one way or another. And this is a good example of how we were payback time.
So that's how Bob experienced it. You've probably heard a bit about the famous Doolittle raid on Tokyo, launched from the deck of the Hornet on April 18th, 1942. And of course, America learned about it through the newspapers, on the radio, and from newsreels. So let's take a time machine back to 1942, if we can. You might have seen this newsreel from Castle Films, the headline, Yanks Bomb Tokyo, and the commentator, Basil Rysdale.
Packed on the after deck of the Hornet are 16 B-25 Mitchell bombers. Never before have these huge planes been launched from a carrier. High explosive and demolition bombs are made ready for the destruction of military objectives in Japan. Colonel, now Major General Doolittle, with Captain Mark Mitcher, commander of the aircraft carrier Hornet, who was once decorated by Japan, now gives his medal to be returned to the Japs on the tail of a bomb. Not until they are miles at sea do these men know definitely the mission for which they have volunteered. Closer and closer they approach enemy-controlled waters and the danger of discovery. Suddenly, a strange vessel is sighted. It's a Jap patrol boat, and the task force intends to destroy it before a warning can be radioed to Japan. A lifeboat goes to pick up Jap survivors. It is feared they have flashed the news to heavy Jap naval forces in the vicinity. Survivors are picked up and brought aboard. Jimmy Doolittle asks Admiral Halsey to go in closer for another hour and a half. And now the signal is flashed for the takeoff, 10 hours ahead of schedule. Doolittle pilots the lead plane. There's a breathless moment as the big bomber gathers speed. It's airborne. The first Army bomber ever to be launched from a carrier is safely in the air. Now they know it can be done, and they time their takeoff with the upsurge of the bow of the carrier in the heavy sea. The defense system, as they practice it here, proves disorganized and panic-stricken when Doolittle and his men catch them flat-footed. Not a single shell fragment hit a plane. The loss of face by Tokyo may well have driven the Japs into the disastrous Midway expedition and its staggering losses of ships and men. Later, in China, the flyers who bailed out safely are decorated by Madame Chiang Kai-shek. The smiling Jimmy Doolittle does not yet know the fate of some of his comrades.
No, he didn't. He would learn later that 11 men were killed or captured by the Japanese, 3 of them executed in captivity. All of the aircraft, of course, were lost, but the emotional blow, the symbolism of that unexpected strike, carried great value for America and its allies. Doolittle, who once feared that he may be court-martialed as a failure, was awarded our nation's highest military decoration, the Medal of Honor. Bob Cole once posed for a photo with Jimmy Doolittle aboard the Hornet.
Sad part of it is I had a lot of pictures taken with the pilots. I had a picture taken with General Doolittle, and I lost them all when the ship went down.
You had that film in your locker.
I had a film in my locker, plus my $2, plus all my clothes.
Was there anything else that you want to say about Doolittle and that raid and what it means to you still today?
You know, I feel honored that I had a little tiny bit to do with that raid, just a tiny bit, because all the things should go toward Doolittle and their crew and how they, all the time they spent practicing how to go off an aircraft or someplace else. I think that was great for their part.
The thing that wasn't so great for you, they were gone, and they had their own survival things to deal with, but what they did made your ship a target. The Japanese knew the aircraft carrier that had launched those planes, and that meant there was a bigger price tag on the Hornet's head than just about anybody else. Did you guys realize that at the time, that you were marked?
No, you know, it's quite an incident, because out there where we got sunk, we weren't the only aircraft carrier that got sunk out there.
We'll hear about that day that nearly ended his life, and more on what the discovery of the Hornet here in 2019, 77 years after its sinking, means to this now 96-year-old. Check out the photos and video online at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this.